Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, experts say Indonesia is experiencing unexpectedly high rates of children stunting. Studies show that many Indonesian children are stunted in their growth. They fail to grow as large as their parents. They also develop at a slower rate than healthy boys and girls. A World Bank publication reports that 37% of Indonesia's children were stunted in 2013. That percentage is similar to some poor African countries south of the Sahara Desert. The bank noted that stunting can limit a child's physical and mental abilities and cause lifelong damage. The World Health Organization defines stunting as restricted growth and development that children experience from poor nutrition, repeated infection, and lack of psychosocial stimulation. Now, the Indonesian government is declaring war on childhood stunting. The health ministry and other government agencies have worked to fight the problem for years. But the administration of President Joko Jokowi Widodo has made dealing with stunting an issue of national importance. He talked about it in an Independence Day speech last year. Health experts say the first 1,000 days of a child's life are important in preventing stunting. They say children require good nutrition, stimulation and activity, clean water, and timely treatment of conditions like diarrhea and malaria. Stunting affects more than 1 in 3 Indonesian children. That means about 9 million children in Southeast Asia's most populous country are suffering from developmental limitations. The poorest areas have the highest rates of childhood stunting. The eastern province of Nusa Tenggara Timur have a 52% rate, the country's highest. But stunting affects developed areas, with some rates among the wealthy as high as 29%. Dr. Brian Triprahastuti serves as an advisor to the Indonesian president on the issue of stunting. He said the reasons for the stunting problem today go beyond the usual issues of poverty and limited access to public services. He said that officials believe that behavior is the main problem of this stunting issue. In the World Bank publication, Jokowi called current stunting rates unacceptable. He promised to prevent 2 million children from being stunted by 2021. He said that ending stunting is a main priority for our government. Jim Yong Kim is president of the World Bank Group. He said the Indonesian government is investing in what he said are evidence-based interventions across 100 districts. He added that the government plans to expand the program to all 541 districts by 2021. Triprahastuti of the president's office said that the government was accepting a human rights-based approach. He said, "For all pregnant women in Indonesia, everywhere, for all children under 2, everywhere, we have to support them. Claudia Rocks is a World Bank health specialist. She said Indonesian officials know they have a huge problem and are ready to do something about it. She added, everything is in place for them to do it well. They just have to coordinate better, be persistent, and make sure that these kids get the best start in life they can get.
On a summer Saturday in St. Paul, Minnesota, a farmer's market was busy with shoppers. The market has many loyal customers who know they can find locally grown fruits and vegetables, as well as handmade cheeses, meats, honey, and other products. Alyssa Erding is among the buyers.
I love that I get to talk with the people who are growing my food. I feel really good knowing that I know where it came from and that it came from somewhere close and somewhere that I consider to be home.
The St. Paul Market only sells fruits and vegetables grown within 80 kilometers, and it does not permit middlemen. In other words, the growers are the sellers, too. Mike Gerton's family began selling vegetables at the market more than 150 years ago.
My family came from Germany and Denmark. I was born into the truck gardening business. I took over from my father. We go back for at least four generations on the St. Paul Farmers Market. We started when it started.
The market is much the same as it was in 1854, the year it opened. That was 4 years before Minnesota became a state. At that time, the town built a small brick building to house the first public market. It offered vegetables in season, breads, and milk products. As America grew and modernized, people stopped going to farmers' markets. They favored big food stores. But in the last 40 years, farmers' markets have had a renewal. The U.S. Agricultural Department says there were about 1,755 in the country in 1999. Now, they number over 8,600, the agency reports. In St. Paul, the arrival of the Hmong refugees in the 1970s and 80s gave the market a second life. The Hmong came from Vietnam, Thailand, and Laos, cultures where nearly everyone shops in outside markets. Farmer Der Tau was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Her father is from Laos.
We've been at the farmers market for over 30 years, so this is pretty much our second home here.
Hmong growers make up 50% of the market's sellers now. The business is really good, said Tiao. Other immigrant farmers have joined the market more recently, like Susan Dahl.
I came from Nepal in 1997. I sell raw honey. That's what we produce. We have hives. And I love being with the people, and I enjoy being in the market just like a home.
Somali seller Ibu Ege joined the market last May.
I make some different hot sauces. Some of them are from my country flavors and background. The rest is something that I created for my family.
Shopper Ryan Rapaz praises the product.
I just bought the Hebo hot sauce from a Somali vendor. In addition to wanting to buy it because it's an absolute excellent hot sauce, we come here to support local farmers and local vendors who's from the immigrant community.
The U.S. government has helped with the growth of farmers markets through a financial assistance program. Since 2006, the Farmers Market Promotion Program has worked to increase the purchase of locally grown fruits and vegetables. It also wants to create new market possibilities for American farmers. But money for the program is not included in the 2019 federal budget, which may affect small markets around the country. Jim Golden directs the St. Paul Growers Association, which runs the market. He says there is something magical about the place.
It feels like a family here. It feels like a big family with all the growers, and it feels like a big family with all the customers. And you see people over, you know, really, you know, years and years and years and years.
I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Air pollution is a killer. The World Health Organization says it kills an estimated 7 million people around the world each year. Even if polluted air does not kill us, it can make us very sick. However, breathing dirty air may do more than hurt your body. It can also affect your brain and your ability to think. A new study shows that air pollution can cause a huge reduction in our intelligence. The study was a project involving researchers at Peking University in China and Yale University in the United States. The researchers reported that long-term exposure to air pollution can affect a person's mental abilities in two areas, language and mathematics. The researchers studied about 25,000 people from across China. Between 2010 and 2014, these Chinese men, women, and children were given language and math tests. Then researchers compared the test results with measurements of pollution in the air, namely nitrogen dioxide and sulfur dioxide. Shi Chen of the Yale School of Public Health led the study. He and his team found that breathing polluted air can reduce a person's education level by about 1 year. Chen said that the effect generally is worse for those over 64 years of age, for men, and for those with little or no education.
The older persons, they are more affected. And we find quite interestingly, males are more affected than females. And people working outdoors are more affected than people working indoors.
He noted that the youngest people in the study were 10 years old, while the oldest was 90. They came from 25 of China's 33 provinces. In his words, this range of ages and locations across the country provided a good representative sample. The researchers noted that the effect of pollution on verbal ability is even more serious as people age, especially among men and the less educated. Xi Chen told VOA that there are two main kinds of tissue in the brain, white matter and gray matter. White matter, he said, is more connected with a person's language skills, while gray matter is connected to our ability to solve math problems. Other studies, he noted, have shown that air pollution has a great effect on the white matter in the brain, but not the gray matter.
Our findings are very consistent with the hypothesis that the white matter is the key to explain this result. In our brains, we have two main tissues. One is white matter, the other is gray matter. And we know that gray matter is more responsible for people's math skills, but white matter is more related to people's language skills. So that's why we find a much larger effect on the language skills.
Chen said that air pollution did affect the math skills of the study participants, just not as much as their language skills. The study was carried out in a single country, but the findings may be important to people all over the world, especially those living in highly polluted areas. In May 2018, the WHO reported that 9 of every 10 people worldwide are breathing polluted air. WHO experts note that of the 7 million deaths from air pollution, more than 90% of air pollution-related deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries in Asia and Africa. In 2018, the WHO found that India had the world's 14 most polluted cities. The study we described earlier found that people who work outdoors fall into a high-risk group. However, that does not mean those who work inside buildings are safe from air pollution. Researcher Xi Chen spoke about the smallest pieces of air pollution, called particulate matter 2.5, or simply PM2.5. These particulates are only 2.5 micrometers long. Sometimes they are even smaller. So you can easily breathe them in, and they are found indoors.
Everyone is actually affected, and there are some studies already showing that the very small particulate matters can go directly into the brain, affecting office workers. So no matter whether you stay outdoor or indoor, everyone is affected. Some studies show that the PM2.5, which is very small particulate matter, 70% of outdoor PM2.5 can go directly into the building.
Chen urges government policymakers to make serious changes.
The longer-term effect suggests to the policymakers that we really need to engage in cleaning up the sky instead of investing in short-term avoidance, for example, the face mask or air filters.
Xi Chen and his team reported their findings in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about James Garfield. He was the 20th president of the United States. Garfield is not one of the best-known presidents. He served only 100 days before he was shot. 11 weeks later, he died from his wounds. But even during Garfield's short time in office, historians say his presidency had problems. Like the president before him, Rutherford B. Hayes, Garfield was from the state of Ohio. Garfield's father died when he was very young. The future president was raised largely by his mother, two older sisters, and a brother. Among all the presidents, Garfield probably was the most poor in his early years. Growing up, he worked as a farmer, a sailor, a carpenter, a teacher, and a janitor. Finally, he earned a position as a student at Williams College in Western Massachusetts. Garfield loved learning. He eventually taught at a school called the Eclectic Institute. Later, he became its president. Garfield married one of his students at the Eclectic Institute, Lucretia Rudolph. She became a teacher, too. The future president and his wife went on to have seven children. Four sons and a daughter survived to adulthood. In time, Garfield moved out of education and into law and politics. He was an anti-slavery activist who did not think the Southern states had a right to withdraw from the Union. When the Civil War came, Garfield welcomed it. During the war, Garfield served in the military as an officer. He won awards for his bravery. While still a young man, he was appointed to the position of Major General. His image as a war hero was so great that Garfield did not have to campaign for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. He was elected on his name alone. Garfield's way of thinking changed while he was in Congress. He began as one of the most extreme radical Republicans. He wanted to punish former Confederate officers severely. But in time, Garfield softened his positions. He learned to compromise with other groups in order to achieve results for his state. But he did not always represent the interests of workers or farmers in Ohio. Garfield supported business interests that wanted to limit the country's money supply. He opposed labor unions and cooperative farm programs, called the Grange. Garfield also became linked to a corruption case. He accepted stock shares in a company that was building a railroad across the country. In exchange, Garfield and other top officials eased government rules so businessmen could earn higher profits for their work. Although Garfield's political career sometimes drew criticism, he continued to rise in government. When Garfield became president in March 1881, he did not have what Americans call a mandate, the approval of a large part of the population. Instead, he needed to make compromises with lawmakers to help win their support. As a result, the first weeks of his presidency were a political struggle to appoint members to his cabinet of advisors. Garfield also clashed with a powerful senator from New York State. The senator wanted to continue the tradition of permitting senators to choose who got government jobs in their states. But President Garfield wanted to put someone who shared his own beliefs in some of the top positions in New York. Finally, the senator resigned in protest. But the issue set the tone for Garfield's short time in office. Elected officials battled each other for advantages and financial gain. Officials in Garfield's party were accused of corruption and wrongdoing. And before Garfield could really suggest any ideas for government reform, he was shot by someone seeking a government job in exchange for his political support. On July 2, 1881, fewer than 4 months after he took office, Garfield was leaving for a short trip with two of his sons. They were going to take a train to Williams, the college Garfield had attended and loved. The president was supposed to give a speech there. But as he walked through the train station, a man with a gun stepped behind Garfield and shot the president twice. One bullet touched Garfield's arm. The other went into his lower back. Garfield did not die immediately. Instead, he was taken back to the White House, where doctors tried to remove the bullet. One of the men who tried was Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. Bell tried to find the bullet by using a device like a metal detector that he had invented. But the springs on Garfield's bed interfered. Neither Bell nor the doctors were able to remove the bullet. And, some historians say, their efforts may have made the situation worse. Garfield suffered for more than 2 months. At one point, he seemed to be recovering. But on September 19th, he finally died. He was 49 years old. As for the gunman, he was captured shortly after the shooting. His name was Charles Guiteau. Guiteau was a lawyer with little money, but many mental problems. During the election of 1880, he had first supported the candidacy of former President Ulysses S. Grant. When Garfield won the Republican nomination instead, Guiteau supported him. Guiteau did not have an official role in the election campaign, and Garfield did not know him. But over time, Guiteau came to believe that he was responsible for Garfield winning the presidency. As a result, Guiteau thought Garfield owed him a government job. Guiteau wrote the president several letters requesting positions as a diplomat in Europe. When Garfield did not write back, Guiteau grew angry. He believed Garfield was ruining the Republican Party and destroying the country. For weeks, Guiteau followed the president and plotted to kill him. When he succeeded in shooting Garfield, Guiteau believed he had performed a great service. At his trial, a jury decided that Guiteau was sane. In other words, he was not too mentally unbalanced to be responsible for his crime. Almost a year after he shot the president, Guiteau himself was hanged. Thus, the most dramatic event in James Garfield's presidency came to an end.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.